Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christine O'Leary, covering an update on the construction of a new Mohawk Language and Cultural Center in Tiahdanaga.
Hello, I'm Christine O'Leary, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
As construction continues on the new Kintege Language and Cultural Center in Tiahdanaga, it has been announced that the center has received a $486,600 GROW grant provided by the provincial government's Ontario Trillium Foundation to be used for the restoration of nature surrounding the center. TTO is an organization that has developed and delivered Mohawk language programs for two decades. TTO is currently in the process of building their new language and cultural center to house and expand their programming, set to open by fall 2025. Over the next 3 years, the GROW grant will be used for the restoration and conservation of 2 acres of forest, wetlands, and meadows surrounding the site. TTO has partnered with Wintergreen Studios for the project, an environmental center located in South Frontenac that works to preserve natural ecosystems and assists other organizations with conservation and sustainability projects. Dr. Rena Upitis, founding director of Wintergreen Studios, shared how the collaboration between TTO and Wintergreen Studios began and led to the project being funded by the GROW grant.
So our association with TTO started several years ago when the school at Tiahdanaga brought some of their students to Wintergreen for a spring land art BioBlitz event. And they've been coming ever since. And I've come to know Callie Hill, who's the chief executive officer at TTO, quite well. And this fall, we decided that the two of us would sit down and write a grant proposal to the Ontario Trillium Foundation. We were absolutely delighted that the Ontario government was funding something that had to do with land restoration, and thrilled to have a formal way of deepening our partnership with TTO.
Ubitus notes that restoration will be a major undertaking given the current state of the land.
The state of the land now is, I would say, damaged by human use and even abuse over the last long while. Before the building began, it was the Shannonville Fairgrounds, and having a fairground and a fairground with animals is not great for natural landscapes. So the way that the land is right now is it's a giant construction site with lots of sand and gravel and quite a few noxious invasive species that tend to pop up on in construction sites. So there's poison parsnip, there are thistles, buckthorn, things that are not conducive to a really diverse and beautiful learning environment. So the land right now, it's not pretty. But once upon a time, it was a place that housed, for example, a lot of milkweed. It was the home to probably most of the monarch butterfly species in the area. So one of the things that we're doing is looking to what used to be there and conserving and regenerating that land so that those kinds of species can thrive again.
The Wintergreen team is already at work, breaking ground just after their launch last week, carefully mapping the current landscape and strategically determining how to restore balance.
We have a number of people who are well-versed in plant life, particularly local and native species and near native species. And we have already started to do a very intense inventory of the plants that are there. Our goal is to ensure that there's a invisible boundary between the existing ecology and what we help with in terms of restoration so that the whole thing becomes seamless.
The restoration will be led by Indigenous ecological knowledge, emphasizing native plants' traditional uses and learning with the land.
And the emphasis, as I said, is on local plants. We're also going to be helping with traditional gardens, medicine gardens, greenhouse, any way we can really to restore the land to what it would have been had a building not popped up in the middle of it. It's a delicate kind of massaging of what's there and what could be introduced so that over time the land takes care of itself.
TTO and Wintergreen are already considering ways the land can be integrated into learning at the center.
One of the things we're looking at planting is nut trees and nut trees that are natural to that area. So that brings into possibility planting, harvesting, preserving, eating all kinds of foods that a food forest can produce. So there's many connections with the work that the center will do with the land itself.
These efforts will take time, far longer than the 3-year grant period. But both organizations are looking forward to the journey ahead.
Well, restoration work takes a long time. We will have, if you'll excuse the pun, the seeds of the project in place at the end of 3 years. But it'll take 20 or 30 years for the landscape to do its own work. And in terms of when we start to see things immediately, we've received the go-ahead. We've had our official launch, and the day of the launch, we had people from Wintergreen out on the land doing surveys and having conversations and discussions about what to plant this summer and what to plant this coming fall.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about findings of the Kingston Police Collision Report for the first quarter of 2025.
Thank you, Jesse. Kingston Police have released their collision report for the first quarter of 2025, covering the period from January 1st to March 31st. The report was compiled by Accident Support Services International Limited. The collision report categorizes incidents into two types, those where police were present at the scene and those that were self-reported. Police were on the scene at 255 collisions in the first quarter of 2025, while 504 collisions were self-reported, for a total of 759, a slight increase over the same period from last year where 744 collisions were counted. Of the collisions where Kingston police were on the scene, there were no fatalities, but 33 non-fatal injuries occurred. In the first quarter of last year, there were no fatal collisions and 29 non-fatal injuries. Of the collisions police were on the scene for in the first quarter of 2025, 203 were deemed as property damage only, or PDO. PDO collisions are those where no injuries are reported, just damage to vehicles or property. There were 18 collisions where no reportable damage was observed. Last year, during the same period, 218 collisions were PDO and 33 involved no reportable damage. The top intersection for collisions in the city of Kingston is at Bath Road and Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard, with 10 collisions reported in the first quarter of 2025. The intersection of Centennial Drive and Taylor Kidd Boulevard was the scene of 7 collisions, as was the intersection of Gardner's Road and Princess Street. These numbers are up slightly from the first quarter of 2024. Last year, Bath and Sir John A. was the site of 7 collisions, and Centennial and Taylor Kidd and Gardner's and Princess were the location of 6. The full collision report for the first quarter of 2025 can be viewed online through the Kingston Police website. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a story from the LGAI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Napanee Council's call for a structural analysis of the Water Street Swing Bridge.
Thank you, Dinah. Gananoque Council has ordered a structural and mechanical analysis of the Water Street Swing Bridge while approving a speed limit reduction on the span and its approaches, dropping from 50 kilometers an hour to 25. The decisions passed during last Tuesday's council meeting come in response to ongoing concerns about the aging bridge's stability, maintenance needs, and public safety. The analysis will focus on the bridge's center pier turning mechanism to determine if any section loss or deterioration could threaten the structure's integrity. Depending on the results, the town may eventually pursue full rehabilitation or replacement. David Armstrong, the town's manager of public works, said the bridge continues to exhibit movement when vehicles pass over, particularly on the east side of the span and when crossing from east to west at higher speeds. Armstrong noted that since he joined the town in 2021, the bridge has never been swung to allow marine traffic through, despite its historical function. Originally built in 1894 as a railway bridge, the structure was converted for road use in 1981 and has been identified by the province as historically significant. The town has approximately $179,000 remaining in its 2025 budget for repairs and maintenance to the bridge, a sum expected to cover the cost of the structural analysis and any immediate maintenance needs identified. The analysis is anticipated to be completed within 4 to 8 weeks.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about Loyalist Township's attempts to secure more housing funding from the Housing Accelerator Fund.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township staff are looking at bringing forth a proposal to permit 4 units as of right in all urban serviced areas. This is an increase from the 3 units as of right currently permitted through Ontario's Bill 23, More Homes Built Faster Act of 2022. Allowing 4 units as of right to support infill development in low-density neighborhoods is a minimum program requirement to apply for the large urban stream of the Housing Accelerator Fund. These actions come as part of the township's council-endorsed action plan for the fund. According to staff, the initiative aims to accelerate the supply of housing by increasing the number of units that can be constructed on a single lot. It also promotes additional infill opportunities within existing established neighborhoods. A statutory public meeting was held last week to obtain public input. Staff noted that all input will be considered as they prepare the final proposal. Development Services Manager Andrea Furness explains how the number of units will work.
These applications are being proposed where there's a principal dwelling on the lot, which could be a single detached dwelling, semi or a townhome. And it could contain 3 extra units within the main dwelling, or it could be in the form of 2 within the dwelling and then 1 as a detached unit, like a coach house.
Furness spoke about regulations they'll be looking to impose as well.
We're proposing zoning performance standards to further regulate the additional units, such as requiring an additional parking space for each unit, and provisions to ensure that the units are secondary to the main principal dwelling house. For the detached units, location, height, and setbacks are also being implemented as well.
Furness spoke about lots and dwellings outside the urban area.
In addition to the urban area, we've also included updated official plan policies for 1 additional residential unit outside the urban areas, so our rural areas and our hamlets, we already have some official plan policies to that effect, and then now we're implementing them through zoning as part of this exercise as well.
Furness detailed some of the difficulties they may face.
Some of the proposed regulations that we're proposing will be difficult to meet in some areas of the townships, particularly in more newer, higher dense subdivisions, primarily due to parking constraints. As an example, for a lot in a new urban subdivision to accommodate 4 units, they would require 5 parking spaces, which is not feasible in majority of the newer subdivisions. Setbacks for detached units could also be limited. On some of the smaller residential lots in new subdivision as well. We've received some public comments to that effect. We'll be reviewing them in greater detail in order to make appropriate changes before we bring a recommendation report back to council.
Furness explained how they'll be looking into parking issues.
Any potential reduced parking requirements requires a much larger review and analysis, which we're doing as part of the overall zoning bylaw review with a traffic and parking consultant. So at this time, we're not proposing any reductions to parking spaces for any second units.
Furness detailed their next steps.
So overall, this is our first draft. We'll be reviewing all feedback received, including comments we already have, and we'll come back to council with a recommendation.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. over to the local journalism initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about Bill Roberts, the first Canadian appointed chair of the Board of Trustees for WPBS-TV.
Bill Roberts is a municipal councillor in Prince Edward County and has recently been appointed the first Canadian to chair the Board of Trustees for the Watertown Public Broadcasting Service. WPBS is a not-for-profit public television station serving eastern Ontario and northern New York State. He has held very senior positions in television, including TV Ontario, Vision TV, CRTC, and many more. Bill talks to us about his background, his new position, and the challenges ahead. Bill Roberts, you're taking on a new position. How does that feel?
Well, it's a big responsibility, but I enjoy a challenge. It seems to be the thing that I do.
And this new position that you're taking, chair of the Board of Trustees for WPBS-TV, how long will you be in the position?
I think there's a two-term limit, so they won't have to put up with me for more than 6 years.
But you've been with them for quite some time in another capacity.
It's nine years that I've been on the board, that's right.
Wow. How did you get involved with that?
Well, my story about public service broadcasting goes back to when I was 12, I think, when my very first paying gig was as a child person in a CBC radio show. So the public service broadcasting thing is kind of bread in the bone. And when I was managing director of TV Ontario, I think you may remember there was a premier named Mike Harris who was very keen to sell and privatize TV Ontario. So I needed to look around pretty quickly to find other sources of revenue and other, just more money. Mm-hmm. And to my surprise, there were 14 actually PBS border stations that stepped up and said, you know, Bill, we'd be happy to work with TV Ontario and, you know, save my butt. Also, luckily, Premier Harris did not privatize TV Ontario, and there I was with 14 new partners to work with. So that was something. And then in 1991, I co-created with colleagues in NHK Japan. NHK is actually the largest public broadcaster in the world. Lots of people think it's the BBC, but it's actually NHK in Japan. We created this thing called Public Broadcasters International, which is now about 40 different public broadcasters from around the world. And we hosted TV Ontario, and when I was an executive there, hosted the first PBI, or Public Broadcasters International. And then right up after that was PBS. They hosted, and last year that was the CBC that hosted, and it's really grown into something. So it's, again, there I was with PBS.
In your new position, what are you hoping to achieve, or what are your goals?
Well, we're up against a mindset. Frankly, it's an ideology which is attacking universities, attacking immigrants, attacking museums, attacking law firms, attacking cultural institutions. And PBS is not spared from that attack by, I think, what's fair to say is an increasingly authoritarian and extreme right-wing agenda in the White House. We're hoping that Congress, at the last minute perhaps, will not claw back what Congress has already passed in terms of funding for PBS. It's weird. Poll after poll after poll done by Democrats, Republicans, Independents, you pick your pollster, come up with PBS being the number one most trusted institution in the United States. And in terms of the American taxpayer, the number two best institution to invest in terms of taxpayer dollars getting benefits to the U.S. military. So, that's sort of what you would think would be the MAGA crowd. And also, we've done some polling more recently within the last year that looks at solid Republican MAGA states. And it would appear from the polling data that at least 65% of Republicans in those states would like to see PBS not only continue to be funded, especially with funds that have already been voted two and 3 years ago, but also increased funding. So hopefully we'll be able to turn that around. But I have some contingencies if we don't. There has not been one Republican administration in the history of the United States that has not gone after zeroing out public broadcasting.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I think people should support public broadcasters. They should support community broadcasters. I think that community broadcasters like 99.3 County FM here in Prince Edward County, student radio is very important. I was involved in student radio when I was at Trent University. It was kind of cut my teeth on that sort of approach to an independent, open mind media. And wherever you are, support your educational broadcaster, Knowledge Network, TV Ontario, TV Quebec, and of course the CBC, Radio-Canada.
Thank you. For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Next up is the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story that covers local calls for the Cobourg mayor's resignation after their controversial remarks about a homeless shelter.
Protesters and counter-protesters clashed Wednesday at Victoria Hall in Cobourg over Mayor Lucas Cleveland's recent public statement regarding open-air drug use and homelessness within the town. In late June, Cleveland issued his letter calling the emergency homeless shelter at 310 Division Street a failure in public policy and that the general public are no longer going to accept the criminality, chaos, and unaccountability. This letter was issued following a four-hour town hall meeting a week prior regarding the homeless shelter where speakers expressed support, opposition, and sympathy for the situation. Since that letter, Cleveland's supporters are backing his tougher stance while his detractors are calling for him to resign. Community activist Teresa Rickerby said that Cleveland needs to be held accountable for his language and treatment of the public, calling for Cleveland to step down.
So the accountability that I'm looking for is accountability in the communication that he's doing, accountability with the way he speaks to council members. Don't know if you guys watch council meetings. Please watch them and see how uncomfortable they are. Accountability for the discomfort that he's caused so many folks in his office.
As approximately 12 protesters were preparing for their demonstration, a man who refused to identify himself began shouting in support of Cleveland, saying the mayor was the only person standing up for the public and what he called the left-wing agenda.
I've watched the meetings. I watch everyone in the council go against him. He's the only one that stands up for the people in this town. He's the only one worth on a council that's worth anything. The rest of them should all be gone.
Cleveland did not appear in front of the protesters at the town hall at a special council meeting on July 3rd. Cleveland refused to participate in that meeting as fellow councillors were set to debate Cleveland's June statement. He pronounced that he would not be resigning and he could not be forced to step down. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, July 24th, a 26-degree day. It's going to be cloudy and humid. Moving now towards the weekend. Friday, July 25th, daytime high of 27 degrees, but a high humidity factor. It's going to be a hot, sticky day here in the city of Kingston. Saturday, July 26th, mostly cloudy, but a little less humid. Still going to be a brilliant, sunny day. Perfect barbecue weather, if I do say so myself. Sunday, July 26th. 7th, daytime high of 27 degrees, feeling closer to 29, so humidity at a low, a little bit of cloud coverage into the afternoon. And then into the start of next week, Monday, July 28th, it's going to be 26 degrees, partly sunny, with the possibility of an afternoon shower. This is the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians on the following dates: July 20th, July 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, and September 7th from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. In the fall, the causeway will be fully closed September 21st, October 5th, 14th, 19th, November 2nd, and 16th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. Here are the road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Abidon Road, Highway 2 to Middle is closed until August 15th for the removal and replacement of a culvert. Albert Street, Princess and Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Baggett Street, Berry to West is closed until July 23rd at 7 p.m. to accommodate pedestrian and participant safety for the Canadian Little League Championship. Brock Street, Division to Palace is closed until July 31st from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day for road resurfacing. Carlton Street, Alfred de Guy is closed until August 8th for a gas main installation. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Victoria, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. And Wise Street, Woodbine to Megan is closed until July 31st to accommodate construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements.
Here are some other delays to be aware of. Accommodation Road, 6th concession to White Church, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Abbeydon Road, Middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catterockway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic is down to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Garrett Road, 6th concession to Sandhill, expect delays while a contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Highway 2 to Abbeydon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main sidewalks, and road. And White Church Road, 6th concession to Woodburn. Expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.